Okay, hello everyone. Thank you so much for coming. And thank you also to everyone joining us online as well. Really looking forward to our event this evening with Maria and Jessica. And thank you to our principal funder, Arts Council England, for your generous support. So I will now introduce our first reader for this evening, who is Jessica Mukherjee. Jessica Mukherjee is a widely published poet of Bengali heritage. She was brought up in Mumbles, Wales, lived in London for most of her adult life, and currently lives in Kent. She is the author of three full collections. Her second, Tigress, published with Nine Arches Press, was shortlisted for the Ledbury Munter Prize for Best Second Collection. Her latest pamphlet is Playlists, published with Broken Sleep Books, and her next collection, Notes from a Shipwreck, will be published with Nine Arches Press next month. Jessica's going to be reading from both of those books this evening, and her upcoming book has been described as an illuminating book of poems of dislocation, voyage, and transformation. Please join me in welcoming Jessica Mukherjee.
Can you hear me okay? Oh, you can. Good. Well, it's fabulous to be here, and I've been here all week, and I think I know you all now, so it's just fabulous to read for you. Well, I'll start from the first poem in Tigress, because it's called A Welcome, and it deals with how people from other cultures are welcomed to this country. So my dad came in the 60s, and it's a sort of poem about him. The Welcome. Toy bright and high rise, England jumps on him from red post boxes, flashing taxicabs, Belisha beacons and yellow lines. He arrives the day Winston Churchill dies. His land was slippery from the Ganges mud, bone-white stones from the Chittagunga hills, where his mother smeared hot ash on her boy's face. In a West London caff, he sees one strange brown man stirring milky tea, shaking, asks him, "Will you help me? Nothing is as beautiful as this other foreign body spilling sugar." In a boarding house with thin curtains, thinner walls, he unpacks smells of his mother, spice, news of war. He listens to the Rolling Stones, wants for something more than Tagore, more than rituals of flowers and ash, more than strikes and men with guns. It takes three nights on the toilet. His guts reject gorges of flyovers, mountains of concrete, wimpy burgers and golden eggs. England, smeared with grime, lands on his head. He turns on the BBC, where men speak in alternating Urdu and Hindi. "Welcome," they tell him from the radio. "There are things about Britain you will need to know." In Dhaka, his boss in the sugar refinery said to him, "There's nothing here for Hindus left. Go where your lot have always gone, on the coattails of those Englishmen." So that was there was a programme on telly when I was a kid, which was a Sunday morning programme, the Asian programme, and all Asian people around about that time would switch it on, and I couldn't really speak my parents' language that well, and they alternated it between Hindi and English, and it was translated as The Welcome, and it was basically a programme to tell Indian people how to behave in Britain. It was quite handy, really, think about it. So how do you become British? How do we become British? What does it mean to be British? These are sort of questions that I'm interested in. And this is a poem called Becoming British. And it talks about the experience my parents had in becoming British. They scramble in drawers for affidavits, letters, proof of purchase, receipts, invoices, voices. Her father was a district judge, Coolner Division, amidst more shouting, letters. We need proof of legitimacy of your marriage. Headlines. National worries of smuggling in foreign women. Whispers. Her father is a stateless person. His affidavit worthless. He fled from Bengal during the riots to Dehradun. What colour is her passport? In a suitcase, under her saris, she strokes her wedding jewels, old blue airmail letters from her father. You will bring shame upon both our families if you don't marry. Must be somewhere. The vows, she said, under the stars, garments tied in flesh red and bone white. We need proof of legitimacy of your marriage. In Kushtia, under the pole star, circling fire and incense smoke, eternity stamped with a priest's thumb, a kick from God. All papers lost. And so Mumbles features quite strongly in this book, and you know, it's a lovely place, and if you haven't been, you should go. It's really nice. And I found it a very welcoming place. There's a poem in my first collection called The Milk, because I mean, we'll talk about it later, but my mother wasn't very well and found it difficult to parent me, and I found that the Welsh people, particularly the older Welsh people, were very keen to bring me in to their world. And I sort of found that, you know, that was something that was important to me. So this poem is called The Truth, because like all little children, you're trying to find out, what is the truth then? Long ago, in the Mumbles, my mother wore saris, all flowing and veiled like the Marys in a giant picture Bible I'd saved up for. My father told me Christ was Krishna, just less colourful. My sister read philosophy, told me about the aching chasms, a universe of infinite space between all bodies, so I hugged her to stop the voice of that truth. She told me Jesus was no more a god than the tree outside our house. I loved that oak, so agreed, and read the Bible more fervently than ever. I liked the Bible pictures because everyone looked dark and foreign like us, with their veils and beads and saris. I went to chapel in the village and heard an old man preaching in his brethren voice. Their Bibles were small, black, with tracing paper pages of tiny words and no spaces. They smiled as I uncovered my Bible for them to see, larger than myself, full colour, illustrated with mountains, so I could fall into the lands of Palestine, Elam, Judah, dance through the deserts, lament at Jesus' feet, and sing, yes, he is a tree. He is as warm as wood. So it was a green shield. Stamps. I don't know if some of you remember them, and you could save them up. And I got a huge Bible that was about this big, and everyone laughed. Never mind. And this poem is called The Welsh House. It got reviewed, the book got reviewed in the TLS, which I was very proud. And I think Stephanie, who reviewed it, she said, you know, this is immigrant Gothic. And I thought, I'll have that. I'll have that. The Welsh house. The house is covered a skull embarrassed by ferns and firs that hold its bone face in quiet shame. The concrete porch steps are now slippery, wet, and covered with slime. I'm careful now, though I bounded up them as a child. You told me I fell at the top of those stairs, and you held me, presenting me to the new house like coming to a new country. We disappeared into this house, where we loved but couldn't touch, leaves against windows, scribbling, shouting, and rain and more rain. Inside mother's silent terror and decay, I grew and left. You clung to that house, to her, year after solitary year. She went mad inside that house, an immigrant madness, lost in Hobson, Jobson and Hub Hub, lost in the Chittagong Hills, lost in the poems of the 12th century Indian kings. I was the foreigner. This house, surrounded by doctors and teachers, decays behind a green tangled fan. It urges me to run away, while both of you have become native to her wet hands. The house whispers, we do things differently here. And it's interesting, I don't know if you know, but Hub Hub and Hobson Jobson, I don't know if you know what that means, but we use the words Hub Hub. And so Hub Hub was the word, the term that was used to describe how Indian language sounded to the people in the Raj. Hub Hub Hub. And Hobson Jobson was the term that Indian people used as that's what English sounded like to Hobson Jobson. So I thought that was quite interesting. How are we doing for time? A couple more. I also write and cover in my work themes about motherhood and unmotherhood and all that spectrum of womanhood. So I'll read this poem. It's called Mate Choice, which is a sort of scientific term for getting a partner. And mating, in fact. Mate choice. You didn't ask me to marry you in words. Your arms, thick as branches, kept me to you, blocking me in. I told you marriage was Darwin's joke, dismissing us, what we could become, pleased at how clever I was. We could have birthed a master race, produced strong and hairy kids. They would have saved the earth from drowning. I would like to save the earth from drowning. Given to my ancestors, we would have raced with our invisible hooves to the end of the world. I feed seas with my genes when oceans rise. Fish feed when I die. I would have liked to have saved the earth from drowning. And I'll finish this bit with a poem which was, in fact, started life as a very famous Welsh medieval poem, but my translation of it was so bad that it just turned into a completely different poem. But nevertheless, it was a good exercise if you want to translate Welsh medieval poetry. So no one will remotely recognise it. But this is my version, and it's called Stranger. I ask the moon to do my dirty work. In the backwash, I wonder if the Welsh god, with his untidy name, painted her. I'm the colour of the rock. I'm the moon-glowing witch with my cloud hands getting slowly drunk as I shrink out of the sky. They ask me why I wear a bone in my nose, and I laugh, make their cows lame and their children fail. Everyone's asleep. I walk the streets where the lights are still on in people's houses. I walk my coast path from West Cross to the Mumbles Head, away from the village, from that old infant school with that big sign that told them to aim for something they must have believed in at the time, where the milk was too warm and made them sick. I flick a switch and turn off all the stars. I drop gold-crushed light on the cliff paths and sit down here on Brandy Cove, sea-faced. They spread rumours that I am the moon and they chase me with silver. I know I can't drown because I am the water.
Thank you so much for that incredible reading, Jess. I'm so glad you read that poem, and that final line, I can't drown because I am the water. Mm-hmm. It's just astonishing. So many lines there, actually. I was jotting them down. So many incredible, credible lines. I was the foreigner. I would love to save the world from drowning. Thank you so much. I should have said earlier, I didn't introduce myself, I'm a Ledbury poetry critic and a poet. My name is Sarah Estrick. We will be having questions towards the end, so I thought I would flag that up while we're having our readings, and we're going to have a bit of discussion. But do be thinking of questions that you would like to ask our two poets. But our second reader today is Maria Jabsiedzka, and poet, translator, and editor Maria Jabsiedzka came to the UK from Warsaw, Poland, as a small child. Her fifth full-length poetry collection, Small Odysseys, will be published by Waterloo Press later this year. It explores the crossing of borders, from minor everyday ones to those of upheaval or insurrection, queering or reimagining the past, questioning the present and future. The true story of Cowboy Hat and Ingenue, this fabulous book here, is her most recent previous collection and was published with Licorice Fish Books. Please join me in welcoming Maria Jabsiedzka.
I'll stand here because I can't actually see over there.
Oh.
This is what I didn't think. Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here with these two gorgeous and very intelligent poets, and lovely to be with you all here. I'm going to do half and half. So I'm going to start by reading from The True Story of Cowboy Hat and Ingenue, which is the story of two women who fall in love and go on a quest to search for Cowboy Hat's daughter, and it's told in prose poems. And their story, in turn, is interwoven with the stories of many other outcasts and refugees from war and oppression. And they include a martial artist, a nun, a brothel keeper, a bearded lady, and so on. And I, with this book, I tend to just read straight through because it's a narrative, and it's a deconstructed narrative, which means you don't really know what's going on. So I hope that you'll just go with the flow for this bit, and then I'll read some poems from the new book. What about the hard kisses? Sometimes they follow the butterfly kisses. If she doesn't feel the same way, I will surely die. Hairbrained, almost harsh, hard up, foolhardy, hard on their luck. They push your tongue into each chink of intimation, nudge right through, find who she and you might be on the other side. But the butterfly kisses, eyelash to eyelash, are equally foolish, silky, hopeful. The two of you, feet tucked under, napping, small. cocoon together, maroon together, morning, noon and night, and each afternoon you want to swoon together. Feeling drunk, you force yourself to go for a glass of water, lurching from side to side like someone crossing the length of a train, holding out your arms for distance. On a day without any breeze, the commander is strolling across the sleepy square when he hears children chasing a round-faced child. Gordita, gordita, cochinita, they call. He asks the priest, his interpreter, what it means, and on learning it means piggy girl, he tells his henchman to find the child. That afternoon, the villagers cannot believe their eyes as the men, having built a huge fire in the centre of the square, hang the child trussed up like an animal over its flames. The child screams, the people plead and shout. The commander inclines his head and the men fire a shot above the crowd. Oh, but it's you who are responsible for this, he drawls. You are the ones who named her Cochinita in the first place. His voice carries in the stillness like smoke, rising lazily on a day without any breeze. A lot of the action takes place at noon. A bear is riding a bicycle around the market square. It wears a red flat cap and a name tag dangles from its neck. In bold letters it says, "My name is Pimpo. Have the ride of your life." Attached to the back of the bike is a little cart. Five or six children at a time can climb onto the cart to be taken round the stalls and into one of the streets which circle the market. Every child who sees the bear begs for a ride. Parents find themselves walking over to the trainer, a man with a face so tattooed you can hardly see his eyes. He smokes one cheroot after another, chewing the ends and spitting them out. "You gotta ask the bear," he says, and tugs a chain on the bear's neck. As he does this, the bear nods its huge brown head. The children climb on, and to their parents' dismay, the man gives the chain one last yank and then lets go. The bear rides off by itself, the children squealing with delight. "I thought this kind of thing was illegal," says Ingenue. "Not round here," mutters Cowboy Hat. One day around noon, just as the market traders are starting to pack up their baskets, one or two calling out a last drop in prices on unsold quinces, turkeys and jamon, and as flies hover over everything, Pimpo sets off on another ride round the square. You can see the bear's red cap disappearing round a corner. The parents wait to wave a greeting to the children. They look for the man with the chain, but he's nowhere to be seen. A stallholder, packing up crates of lemons, shrugs and points to the nearest bar. The adults split into two groups and run down either end of the street which circles the square. But the bear, riding a bicycle, has gone. So I'm going to read from my fourth, this is a very creaky floor. I'm going to read from my forthcoming book, Small Odysseys. And one of the things I'm concerned with in the book is history and narrative and who gets to, and perhaps we'll talk about this some more, but who gets to tell history and who gets to appropriate it. So I'm going to start with a poem set in Berlin, and in fact, the bar is called Eldorados, and it also exists in a different dimension in the previous book. That's just a kind of inner joke. And if anybody here speaks German, please excuse mine. I don't think you have to know what it all means. It's mainly terms of endearment and a little bit of lesbian slang. In jener Nacht, circa 1939. We'd all been to Eldorado's, swaggered back along Motzerstrasse. I was still wearing my sailor's suit as you slipped your hand in mine. Morning sun splashed the pavements, gold like sweet vermouth. From the rickety chaise longue, you shouted, "Gibt's nichts zu trinken," though my head still spun. You unpinned your corsage, threw it on the bureau, lilies among my essay notes. "Mein Augenstern," you'd murmured on the dance floor when I turned you for a gancho. "Nur du allein." Did you mean it? You danced with so many boy girls, called every one your Kesser Vater. When we heard the knocking, you said it was friends following us, though you sounded less sure. I made the mistake of looking at you when the door caved in. They laughed and caught that look easily, like a child's ball plucked midair. One of them pinned you down. So I stared at the desk, the oak floor, as they dragged us out. "Ich liebe dich," I whispered. I'd never said it before. And we were talking earlier about how we're all such a hodgepodge of different ethnicities and nationalities and connections. So this is about my father, who was born in Russia. My mother was born in Ukraine. And, you know, Polish people are very mixed like that. Once in St. Petersburg, my father was born in a matchbox, rattled in his father's pocket. It was dark. He could smell chai brewing, heard a piano. His mother gave him milk in an acorn cup. He waved a blade of grass as a sword, rode on a black beetle's back. When he reached school age, his papa said, "Despite scant portions and hunger in Russia, it's time for you to grow up." When I was a child, I couldn't imagine he'd ever been any different. He was so tall, his voice boomed down from the clouds. It was only many years later, after I'd run away to live by the seaside, that he visited. On arriving, he took a nap. As he dozed on my sofa, though his feet stuck out, he suddenly looked very small. I wanted to wrap him in cotton wool, place him inside a matchbox to keep him close to me wherever I went. And if I learned how to make myself tiny, we could stroll on the beach, arm in arm. He might tell me the story of the firebird lighting the dark with its tail. So this is another poem to do with narrative and history. On the 70th anniversary of the Warsaw Uprising, Ola says, "Oh, politicians, they love a dead hero. All my life, I've wanted to build a shelter." You see, birch bark and mud plaited through boughs of pine keep out the wind. I'd lean my shelter of debris against a dry base of spruce, save the lower twigs for tinder. Those whose bodies lie under open sky, I'd hide them, wounded, dead, with no one beside them, in war, in peacetime. But if I ask Yula and Ola what poems should be about, they say, write about this day and the next, about quarrelling, then running for the bus, about dropping your ticket. Write about birches if you must, but mostly write about kissing. So I'm going to finish with two more poems. As you probably know, after the Brexit referendum result was announced, violence and attacks against people from ethnic and national minorities in the UK increased. Even the police had to admit that. And all the different minorities were attacked, and among them were the Poles. And cards were posted through Polish people's letterboxes saying, no more Polish vermin, and go home. So being a poet, I thought I'd write about vermin. Who are we, Mama? Are we earthworm turning, shiny railroad worm flashing green and red, bloodworm dying in enormous heaps which make noses wrinkle, inchworm measuring new land in loops? Is this what vermin means, Mama? Enchanting glowworm, Mama. Maybe mealworm to be snacked on, Mama. Hard-working silkworm or woolly bearworm, surviving winters, rolling into a ball if picked up. Mama, are we pigeon, crow, snake, rat, little mouse, flea? I don't mind being puma. Someone said they'd seen one. Or red kite, nearly extinct, but look at their long wings. Mama, we could be fox, wolf, something shy that burrows, or something that digs its hooves in. But what are they who call us them when we are us? Clouds that drift, particles of dust, to be cherished or lost. No beseeching. Same as us, Mama. And I'll finish with a poem about the Buria, which is a northeastern wind which you come across in the Balkans and in Turkey. And there's a Slovene word, gospodar, in it, and that just means a landlord or a host. Buria. This is nothing, your gospodar, still in shirt sleeves, will say. What will you save when the buria comes? Grab your laptop? It won't work. Hold on to granddad's mahogany bureau? Snatch love letters? The cracked blue jug? Who will you call if the lines aren't down when the buria comes? She'll turn trucks over like toys, rip concrete pillars up. She'll pull trees up by their roots as if they were weeds, kick bridges over, knock fences down. What's that whining outside? No more sounds of the cicada by day, no owls hooting at night when the buria comes. Weigh down the roof tiles with rocks, build your houses close, face them south, drag chains or ropes down the streets to catch hold of in snow. From chiara to scura, she'll grow even colder. She can blow a general's spears and arrows straight back at him mid-flight. She'll find hidden graves under hypermarkets and hotels or covered in sinewy grass. One by one, she'll lift the bones out to play with like dolls. When the buria comes, she'll crackle and roar, pelt your windows with scree. Hands over ears, you'll fall on your knees. There'll be nothing left, not a wolf howling. When the buria comes, when the buria comes.
Thank you so much, Maria, for that really incredible reading and some very devastating moments there, actually. very, very powerful. Some lines there that just sort of really came out at me. All my life, I'd wanted to build a shelter. That's a real, or is it create a shelter? It's a real moment of tenderness there, and just really moving. And then from your Brexit poem, what are they that call us them when we are us? I mean, that's an incredible line. Thank you. So now we have time for some questions. I've got a couple of questions for Maria and Jessica, and then you should also be thinking of any questions you'd love to ask our poets. There'll be a roving mic, and I'll open it out to you after I've asked these two questions. So thank you so much again for those readings. And I wanted to talk about, so in your work, you both explore what it means to be foreign and various ways in which people are made to feel like outsiders, made to feel other. But you also both describe moments of real connection to the land, to the body, and also to and with other people. So could you speak a bit about how land and borders, both literal and figurative, appear in your work, and why this is important to you as a poet? Who'd like to go first?
Go for it. You're so polite.
Well, it's funny to talk about foreignness. You know, when I was born in Luton, you know, and you sort of think, okay. And, you know, I always tell, I sort of, it's in that poem, Stranger, actually, the bone through your nose, because when I was a kid, I remember going just when I was in school, and I remember a kid called Alan, I remember him, and he said, why haven't you got bone through your nose? And I didn't know. I thought, I don't know what you're talking about. I was four, you know. You think, what are you talking about? So I went home to my dad, and I said, Alan said, why haven't I got bone through my nose? And my dad was apoplectic, so angry. And he said, you go back to Alan and you tell him that we were inventing algebra when he was living in a cave. And I thought, wow, I don't understand anything. I don't know what algebra is. I don't know what caves have got to do with it. I don't know what a bone is, so I went to Alan and I said, anyway, my dad says, and he went, well, that sounds impressive. And that was it, you know. And then there was another sort of incident when, and this is very formative, and I think kids, when you're new in school, you're in a new school, you're foreign anyway, because you're in a new environment. My parents had made a big deal moving to Wales from England. So we'd gone to Wales. My mum didn't know what Wales was. And so these kids came out and said, so are you, where are you from? And I was, you know, four, you know, and I just went, well, this, you know, my whole future in this environment rests on the answer to this question. So I thought, you know, I think they mean what colour is your skin. You know, I was astute, you know, child. Yeah, I thought they mean about the skin thing. And I said, well, India, you know. And they went, oh, thank God, because we thought you were English. And because they were really unhappy with that. And I was like, this is a minefield, you know. It's a minefield of an arena to get involved in, you know. So at four, I thought, you know, if you're going to be a writer, you know, tread carefully around all of these issues. Note to self, you know. So and these all come through in my poetry. So you know, and my parents are from Bangladesh, but they're Hindus in Bangladesh, so they were a minority. In a country that is mainly Islamic. And there wasn't a problem with that. They felt Bengali and Indian. And there was a war. And that country was created as Bangladesh. But my family had to leave and go to India, which they hadn't know. They had no. They didn't know what that was. You know, they had ponds and fields and land in Bangladesh. So, you know, suddenly we're in Wales. What's Wales? You know. So I think these are very mutable things, land. And here we are, we're in Herefordshire, where I believe you can still kill a Welshman. I think, I don't know, is that a myth? You know, but, you know, we're in the border countries here. You know, be careful when you're in liminal territory, because you never know what's going to happen. I feel that in the poetry here. It's a liminal space. You know, one minute you're in, are you in Wales? Are you in... And then, you know, we heard all this language, didn't we? Catterick. Kettering. You know, this Brythonic world bubbles under us in England. And I think in what I try to do here is try to bring a sense of foreignness, as I think all poets do, actually. Mm-hmm. I think that's our job. I think we had that... was it Irina? The fantastic Ukrainian poet, and she was saying, you know, our job is, I can't say it the way she said it, but this condensation of language to make things appear different and special and sparkly and see it again with new eyes. So I think that's a kind of foreignness as well, and a beautiful thing that poets can do. I hope I try to do that anyway.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
I completely agree. I mean, I think all poets, and probably everybody here, feels foreign to some degree or another. And I think we're crossing borders all the time, whether it's from jobs, whether it's north-south, whether it's, into one relationship or another relationship. You know, there's clubs, there's ways of speaking, there's ways of dressing. I think in our case, there's sort of literal foreignness as well. And, I mean, when I first went to school, I didn't speak a word of English.
You picked it up really well.
It's not bad.
I think you've done well. I've written a book.
Well, you know what I did? Because I couldn't speak any English, I saw... two little girls with brown skin, and I went and stood next to them, and I think I'm still doing the same.
We let you in.
And nothing's changed. Because
stick
that was,
with us, Maria.
That was my safe place to go, and I couldn't say a word. I didn't know what to say to them, so I just stood very close and hoped that would be okay. So, yeah, I mean, I think all kids go through that, and... So I'm very concerned with every kind of border, but also, you know, what happens to you at borders, and, you know, I've written in Small Odysseys, there's a poem about having to hand over your papers when you cross a border and all of that. But I think you hand over quite a lot more sometimes. And we were talking about this with Alison Hallett earlier on. You know, when you cross a border, what happens to you? What have you got to give up in order to get in to whatever environment you're going into? And I think for Polish people, I know what Polish people give up because I've talked to so many other Poles, and it's often that sense of you have, as a Pole coming into a sort of Anglo environment, you feel you're too intense, you're too loud, you're too... absolutely everything. And so you try to kind of hone that down and you sort of try and polish off these rough edges. And it's awful, actually.
Well, I think it's
I'm joking about it, but it's awful because it destroys you and it destroys parts of you. And I think that does happen.
Well, I think that's the same as well for anyone who feels they're from a different... I mean, you have the same with Indian people. They tone it down. Tone it down all the time. Tame yourself.
But in terms of what you were saying about landscapes, I think, I mean, we both write about literal landscapes to some extent, but I think we also write about internal landscapes. Yeah. And that's the whole thing of what we're, what we're trying to do as poets. Yeah. And a lot of the landscapes, I think, in my books are imaginary landscapes that characters or people or the narrator or I enter
I wonder if one of the things that we do as well as people who can be considered other is we allow everyone to be other. You know, it's like, yeah, come in. It's you know, you too can be different, and it's okay.
Yeah.
It's a good space.
Yeah.
You know, we will be the land of the others and
some freedom.
Yeah.
In space.
And I wonder whether that's something that you do consciously, because I do try to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And also that place where those things that have been left behind or have been quashed down can actually flourish as well, which is so important.
It's permission
we need those
to let them grow, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was thinking about that, the kinship in the indifference that you were talking to earlier. And thank you. Right, I don't know whether we ought to, I think we had better get on with audience questions here,
sure.
Actually, because we're cracking on for time. Do we have any questions from the audience? We have a roving mic. Yes, one over here. Do we have a roving mic? Thank you.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the borders and the foreignness between parents or grandparents that lived in another place and yourself. Because I had an experience with my late wife. We went to Ireland and we realised that what we'd inherited wasn't the place we'd gone to visit.
Yeah.
And that was both liberating and also very upsetting.
Yeah, I have a poem in here exactly about that. So it's my Sylvia Plath Daddy poem, you know, and it's in there, and it's basically a poem about a man who is trapped in a land that no longer exists, that he's in two places, and you know he has a daughter who wants to try and connect with him. But can't, because he's in none of these landscapes, actually. He's in an imagined place. And it's the sadness of that. Yeah, so that's in here. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think it's Salman Rushdie writes about that, doesn't he? The imaginary homeland of the diasporic.
And also that we're the children of people who suffered immense trauma.
Yeah.
Not only dislocation, but lived through horrendous forced displacement, war, you know, all of that. And so that's part of our legacy, and it's a mixed legacy. You know, there's incredible cultural richness and there's incredible pain as well.
Yeah. And I want to bring Wales back into that, actually, because one of the things I connected with as a child in Wales was that feeling in Welsh people. They spoke of not being able to speak Welsh. They spoke of a land that no longer existed. They talked about Owain Glyndŵr. And I thought there's a lot of similarities here between them and my dad. So I think that there's also, in this land, and most British people who've got some Irish heritage, I mean, and working class, you know, class comes into it as well.
Yeah.
There's all fractures there.
Yeah.
Good line.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have, I think we only have time for maybe one or two, possibly two questions. Anyone else have a question? Anyone at home? Do we have anyone online who has a question?
It's sort of formulating in my head as a question. It's about sort of how we look at cultural heritage and censorship and education and where there's a place for opening it up as a space that we can all inhabit, or where we have to be a bit PC in modern parlance and start to censor it. And I wondered if you've got thoughts on that, about what it is we're teaching our children, where we allow poetry in, art in, and where we need to change it. It's not really. It's sort of that.
Could you repeat the question, Sarah? Because I didn't quite hear.
It's a question about cultural heritage and education, and where we censor and where we also allow that space to be truly open, so that people can go and discover.
It's a very big question, and you know, again, we've only got a little bit of time. But I mean, this is, and you say PC, I think the way I would see it is to be respectful. Mm. And I think respect, it goes both ways. And I think, so in ethnicity, in your ethnicity form, I always put British Indian. Why? My family are from Bangladesh. My sister puts Bangladesh. I don't put Bangladesh. Why? I mean, I could have a big conversation about colonialism and why put India, why put... Because my dad had British India on his passport. Is that why? What's my connection to India? She puts Bangladesh because that's the land where my mother was born in. But I don't. I think there's room for multiple identities and conversations about that in poetry. I think as long as we respect that and I don't say, well, you're wrong, you know, and she doesn't say I'm wrong. These things are sort of pretty much like arguing about Harry Potter to a certain extent, you know, because it's sort of made up. But I think they're very powerful to people as well, you know.
And language is really precious. And yeah. I didn't completely understand the question, but people talk about PC as though it was something
bad
or wrong. And because it includes the word correctness, we all sort of think, oh, well, let's rebel against correctness. But actually, what we're talking about is getting language that is respectful and that is precise and that is true and real. Yeah. And that's all I want to do, is to be authentic and real. And I think PC is used to put that down and to make it something... kind of, imposed. And what we're after is truth, and whether that's, you know, literal truth or emotional truth or authenticity.
And I think the key thing is every artist knows that context is everything. Mm. That you can say anything at all if the context is right. Comedians know that. Poets know that. So I think, you know, this is about context. You know, a good poet should explain the context within that poem, then, if you're going to use the language.
But in terms of what you communicate to the next generation, I mean, a huge question. Yeah. Because if you're talking about... I mean, you know, I've got a little friend, a little Polish girl, who heard about the war in the Ukraine and burst into tears. And it's like, how do you talk to children about genocide and atrocity? I mean, that's a massive, massive question, which I don't think we can probably cover now, but we have to find some way without overloading them, but to give them a hand.
Yeah, big question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for your questions. We have unfortunately run out of time for our questions now. We do have time, I think, for a short poem from both of you to finish up.
Do you want to do yours, and then I'll finish?
Oh, God, what should I do? Okay.
Well, we've been talking about communication, and so here is a love poem, and it's both about the difficulty of communication and the hope for it, and it's the title poem of my new collection. Small Odysseys. I had forgotten about the blue wheelbarrows, how they always seemed to be stacked in pairs, leaning against a limestone wall, the abundance of lemons like golden eggs heaped on a plate, that the word hieraki means hawk, its body splitting open the sky as it swoops down, or how tiny bubbles of air leave my mouth to enter indigo water. When I lift my head, all the familiar sounds return. The ferry's engine, goats bleating. Coco the parrot, who has learnt to mew like a cat, and out of loneliness, to ring like a telephone. I'd forgotten there's no signal, no way to reach you, only sea rocking back and forth, in and out, like the breath of the cove. Dziękuję bardzo, thank you. Brilliant.
And because Maria has read from her next collection, I'm going to read. This is from my next collection. And this is called No Place Like Home.
Oh, I love this one.
Yeah, me too.
She didn't want Angela Merkel to take our queen. She kept saying it over and over, that little woman from the village, clicking ruby slippers while I grumbled about petrol prices. She must have thought me stuck up, though nice enough to pass the day before the post office shut. I drive in the pouring rain until I get to the coast, and I would have driven into the sea if I'd not run out of petrol. Wolf clouds mock me, tell me I've nothing here, no children, a failure, some kind of aberration. This is the wrong country. I'd worn the wrong shoes, my father said. I had the wrong man living in my house, the wrong head, the wrong country, the wrong world on the wrong shoulders. I went out on my own last night to a Korean restaurant, ordered the wrong thing again, and everything else, everyone else's, was better. There's a German word for that, I'm sure. And I was given silver chopsticks by a girl with great hair. I felt like crying. My sister phones and speaks to me like a stranger about our father. I want to tell her to see a shrink and hang up, but I say things will be fine. There's nonsense on the radio, and I drive home. Later, I watch a documentary about the Inuit and how they have lost their rights to hunt whales. The ice is evaporating. For some people, there is no place like home.